Hello and welcome to another edition of Turn Out a Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, one third of the greatest rock and roll band ever from Husker Du, now on tour with his brand new fantastic band, Ultra Bomb, Greg Norton is here. More on that in 1 second, but first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and normally guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham, but shout out to Melanie Kay for booking this episode. He will get the message to me. You can find me over at Twitter or Instagram at Left for Damian. There is a TikTok page, a YouTube page, channel, a Instagram page and a Facebook page, all for this podcast at Turned Out a Punk on those respective platforms. I play in a band. We are called Fucked Up, and we are going to be going on tour with one of my favorite groups, another one of my favorite groups, the Hallucination. We will be going across Canada with them, and our buddy Daniel Maccabe will be joining us for some of the dates, doing some wrestling stuff. It's going to be a show and a half. I promise you that. You can find out more information over at fuckedup.cc and pick up tickets and come hang out. It's going to be a fun, I think it's going to be probably the most fun Fucked Up show ever. I know that's putting a lot of burden on this thing, but I kind of got that feeling. And there's going to be some stuff dropping this week about that tour. Some music. Spoiler. All right, more information once again, fuckedup.cc. On to today's show. As I said off the top, thank you to my buddy Melanie Kay, because when she called me and said, would you like to have Greg Norton on the show? I said, absolutely, because as I mentioned, I think Husker Du are probably like the greatest rock and roll band, one of, if not the, for me, of all time. Like a band that has inspired me so much, inspired my band, some members, more than they even admit. And there is a huge, huge debt that is owed to this band by everyone here. And so, yeah, Greg is someone I've always wanted to talk to, someone I've never had a chance to meet, someone who stopped playing music for a number of years. And we talk about all of that on this show. As I also said off the top, Ultra Bomb have a brand new album, Time to Burn. You can pick it up over at ultrabomb.com. And ultrabombmusic.com. And while you're over there, check out the tour dates, because I also, as I said, Greg is currently on tour with Ultra Bomb across the United States. You can see them starting Indianapolis, if you're listening to this the day it drops, and there's going to be tons of other shows coming up. So you can go over to ultrabombmusic.com, find out tickets and dates for those shows, and go and check out Ultra Bomb's record, as I said, because it is a great record. And I think you will probably enjoy the live show. I wish it was coming to Canada, but it is not. But you can go to it if you're in the States. And they're playing Punk Rock Bowling. So if you're going to Punk Rock Bowling, be sure to check out Ultra Bomb down there. I think that's it for me. I don't know if I have anything to keep dragging this out with other than to say I hope you enjoy this one. Thanks again to Melanie. And check out Ultra Bomb on tour. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Greg Norton on Turned Out a Punk. Greg, thank you so much for coming on the show.
It is my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, as I was just telling you off air, you're a huge influence on, not only myself, actually. Like, I think you're just one of the most, you know, as part of Husker Du, one of the most influential bands, in modern music history, but also a member of Shotgun Rationale, a band that I have loved, and I'm very curious to find out about all this. But I got to start it off the way they all start off, which is, Greg, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across it?
Yes, I do. So, I graduated high school in 1977. There was a young lady in my journalism class who she really liked this band called Ultravox, and their first record is one of my all time favorites.
Fantastic.
But so anyway, get out of high school and the following winter, a friend of mine gets a job working in a record store at a suburban mall. And it gets me a job at the same record store where that's, you know, I happen to run into this kid out at the food court, and he's like, "Hey, you took my job." And I'm like, "Who are you?" And he's like, "My name's Grant, and I was supposed to get that job." And so I brought Grant back into the store, talked my friend Bill into giving him a job too. And Grant, that's how I met Grant Hart. We became really good friends. You know, so this is spring of 78. All of these great records are just starting to get released. Putting them on, listening to them, it was like, holy cow, what is this stuff? You know, it's like, oh, sorry, my dog likes to bark at the wind. you know, that the Radio Birdman and the Saints on and the Talking Heads and the Ramones, I think Sire Records, their big advertising push was new wave, get behind it before it gets past you, you know, which I think is so funny. And but you know, Patti Smith and the Sex Pistols and the Vibrators and just all of this stuff coming out. A local punk band called the Suicide Commandos released their only record on Blank Records, and the other band assigned to Blank was Para Ubu. Grant and I started going to the Longhorn in Minneapolis to see shows. We saw so many great shows down there. End up meeting Bob Mould later, you know, at the end of that summer. But no, the first time I heard punk, it just like blew me away. And I'm like, wow, this is kind of what my life has been missing.
Working at a record store too, it's kind of like, you know, you're privy to this whole explosion that's happening, like you brought up at this time, where it's sort of this cultural groundswell that really starts, I think, for me, you know, around 74, when you have like Dr. Feelgood. At the same time, you have kind of like these percolations of stuff happening with like the Nerves and stuff in LA. Mm-hmm. But it, you know, as this thing kind of hits, did like, what were you into kind of prior to this in terms of music?
You know, I had very eclectic tastes. My dad was really into big band music, Stan Kenton in particular, and he loved Tony Bennett. My siblings are a bit older than I am, so my sister was, you know, a teenager in the early 60s with you know, the British Invasion and the Beatles in particular. My brother was you know, bringing home, you know, Hendrix and Zeppelin and Black Sabbath and stuff like that. I had actually been hanging out in record stores for, you know, a good 4 or 5 years before starting to work in one. In the store that I hung out in, the two main clerks, they were actually, you know, so 72, 73, 74, you know, so many great records coming out. Mm-hmm. But the guys that were working the counter, they were jazz guys. So one was really into John Coltrane, the other one was really into Miles Davis. Got turned on to like Morton Subotnick and electronic music. You know, it's even listened to some Karlheinz Stockhausen in high school type of thing. You know, it's listened to a lot of weird shit.
Yeah.
So punk kind of fell right in my wheelhouse, so to speak, you know. But then again, it's like all my high school friends were into like Marshall Tucker Band and the Allman Brothers, and yeah, and I mean, those were great bands too, you know. They put out really great records, but it just didn't resonate the same way that punk did with me. And I think it was I had a lot of very talented musician friends in high school, and they always felt they were way more talented than I was, and that I could never play as well as, or sing as well as they did. And then punk came along and like, I can fucking do that, you know?
Yeah, it feels like it was a, you know, and it still is, this sort of accessible genre for a young person where you don't have to like look at these heroes that seem to be carved out of marble. Like this is something that you can do. And because of that, you know, like it's way more important to me to hear someone passionate about something. And I think that's kind of like where we've moved music wise. Like people want to hear the passion more than they want to hear virtuosity at this point.
Right. Yep. Well, you know, definitely. I definitely had those heroes though, too, you know, two bands that went on to superstardom that I hated after they made it really big was Fleetwood Mac. Basically, after the Peter Green left the band, I thought they were just, you know, schlock commercialism. And I hate what Roger Waters did to Pink Floyd, starting with The Wall. I think The Wall is the biggest piece of crap that ever got recorded that people just put up on this pedestal and revere as like one of the greatest things ever. In my opinion, I thought it was like, oh, he's trying to fucking be punk. He's not punk. Fuck him.
It's funny you bring up those two bands too, because like, you know, Piper at the Gates of Dawn and certainly Peter Green era Pink Floyd, Fleetwood Mac is this sort of almost like proto-punk in a way. The Groundhogs are kind of that way too. There's a sort of like energy that exists pre this explosion that we're talking about, that you're talking about kind of witnessing firsthand at the record store, that you can kind of feel and trace back all the way, you know, Stooges, Velvet Underground, obviously kind of get celebrated for that. But there's like a lot of other stuff, particularly in England, that's fascinating. Hawkwind and Pink Fairies and all that sort of stuff. And
oh yeah. Yep.
And it'd be interesting because that stuff I'm now, I kind of got in during the reissue boom, but to see that stuff happening at the time, like it would have been really hard to kind of find out about these records. And like, what was drawing you to be that kid in the record store that kind of was, because you had to put in work back then. It wasn't just like an algorithm or a search. It was like, you had to like put up with the assholes of the record store sometimes, and then ultimately become part of that world to kind of find out about all this stuff, because it's deep culture back then.
Yep. You know, the records were coming out. The record companies did a great job with getting promos out. So promos would come in. It's like be a fight over to who can claim it. But you know, opening up store copies, it's like, you know, something came in that was new and you wanted to hear it, you just opened it and played it, you know? Everybody had a stack of records behind the bar that like, you know, I'm going to buy these someday type thing, you know? If it looked punk, we opened it and we played it. And then, you know, obviously there were a lot of bands that like, were like, oh, gee, I better cut my hair and put on a skinny tie and try to fit in with what's going on, or you know, people aren't going to pay any attention to me. So yeah, there were a lot of crappy records too that we listened to, but you know, the thing is we listened to so much and such a, you know, anything that we could get our hands on, and we had a voracious appetite for it. And so when Husker actually finally got together, Grant and I were both working at a smaller record store now over on the McAllister College campus in St. Paul. And it was owned by the same guy who owned the Suburban store that we initially met at. And being on a college campus, it seemed like it was a little bit easier to play punk and stuff like that. Grant had a PA speaker hooked up to the stereo out on the sidewalk one day and was blasting the Ramones. And that's the first time Bob Mould walked by when he showed up for his freshman year in college. He had a brand new spanking black leather jacket, a Johnny Ramone haircut, and Chuck Taylor high tops. And he was like, oh, hey, I know this band, and starts talking to Grant. They became really good friends. You know, I didn't really meet Bob until a few years, not years, but a few months later. But, you know, by the time we actually started playing together, we had all been consuming this punk stew, you know, that, and, So it I don't know, it just everything just kind of clicked and flowed, and Bob turns into this songwriting machine, which was he still is. And yeah, we would just try stuff, try whatever. It's like, you know, when the first song we wrote is a song called Sex Dolls. And we called it Sex Dolls because we thought it sounded like a cross between the Sex Pistols and the New York Dolls.
But that's the thing that's amazing. I think the thing that's amazing about the band is you guys were, you know, all students of music, you know, and this sort of, and I think that's the thing about punk that kind of, it's really like a postmodern genre in the sense that this was sort of like the birth of music critic kind of record store people and culture kind of producing their own music. So these were people that, you know, like not only are you versed in sort of the rock and roll that's happening at the same time, but it's also this sort of free jazz music that's happening and all sorts of exciting stuff. And, you know, you look at that same sort of thing that's happening in Cleveland a few years earlier with like Lautner and Perubu and all these sorts of guys.
Yeah. Rocket from the Tombs.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You know, I think the greatest American punk band that never, you know, never really got the recognition that they should have. And, you know, in a way it sucks that Stiv Bators broke the band up to steal Cheetah Chrome, but we got the Dead Boys and Paraubo out of that. So I guess I can live with that.
Yeah. It's like interesting to think of how it would have gone with those two forces still existing together, because you're right. Like if you look at kind of like, in my opinion, the best Perubu songs. I know that's a very confrontational kind of discussion to bring up, but, and also the best Dead Boys songs on both records. And plus these other songs, you're right. Like if they had put out an album, that would have been, oh my God, that's like that. That's one of the all time great rock records.
Right. Yep.
You mentioned, go on.
Ultra Bomb, just a quick side there, you know, Ultra Bomb, we recorded Sonic Reducer. It's the last song on the record. And we did it in the studio at the very end when we were completely done with the recording. We still had some time and some energy. And we had talked about like, oh, maybe we should do a cover. And all three of us were like, yeah, Sonic Reducer, that's the perfect song. And I sing it. And my vocal channels David Thomas. It doesn't channel Stiv Bators.
You brought up Suicide Commandos earlier. Who were some of the other bands that were sort of early on to that scene that you were hearing about?
In Minneapolis?
Yeah.
So, well, the Suicide Commandos, they were like, you know, they were the big name. They were, and Chris Osgood actually ended up giving Bob Mould some guitar lessons before they broke up. But and Chris has remained very active in the music scene and in the arts scene in Minneapolis and Minnesota. Another one of the big bands was a band called The Suburbs. And, you know, Twin Tone Records was, you know, they put out The Suburbs. They put out the first Replacements records. They were kind of like the big indie independent label. The Suburbs early on were very punk. They evolved to be more new wave, not in a derogatory term way there, but they actually signed to A&M Records. That's a band that is still plays in Minneapolis to, and they sell out First Avenue, which is, you know, 1500 people, in the Twin Cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul. The Suburbs are probably more popular than Husker Du ever was locally, and still are. So, which I think is kind of crazy. But, you know, then obviously, you know, the Replacements were, they came up right at the same time as we did. They were playing the Longhorn when we were, Tommy Stinson was 14, so he had to sit in the dressing room until they played and then have to leave. They're, you know, actually probably one of the best bands that from that era that they were called NNB, and they put out one single locally, a song called Slack. I highly recommend looking that up and listening to it. It's fantastic. They ended up moving to New York to you know, make it make have their big break, and they ended up breaking up once they got out to New York, which was unfortunate. They were a really great band. I don't know. Those are kind of like the main ones.
Were you familiar with the Tulsa Jacks? Like, it was the Jacks from Tulsa, Oklahoma, who moved up for a summer?
Yeah, the name is familiar, but I don't recall. I don't think we ever played with them, or I don't recall seeing them. But the name's definitely familiar. Yeah.
It's a weird tape that you know, kind of showed up, and then it's been reissued on the sort of Jacks larger reissue that came out. But it's got Tommy Stinson, Bob Mould, and Chris from the Suicide Commandos all playing on songs together.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And the Jacks are an incredible power pop band from Tulsa at the time. Mm-hmm. You mentioned also earlier the samplers that were kind of coming around that time period. There's that new wave sampler that I think Sire did. I think it's a double 7-inch that's fantastic, that has, you know, as you said, the Dead Boys. But it's also weirdly, I think, got the Flaming Groovies on it too.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And I was wondering, is that an influence on you guys early on as well? Because obviously melody is such a huge part of the band.
Yes, it was. You know, actually, we're all three of us were loved power pop. You know, in a way, I think Bob wanted the band to be a power pop band more than a punk band. So, you know, and I think that influence comes through the music. You know, it's you know, Husker wrote melodic punk, right? Mm-hmm. Hardcore that you could whistle to. But yeah, it's and there again, it's like the a lot of that stuff, the garage stuff, you know, the big hits of Mid-America, the, you know, the, all those garage band and psych surf bands and stuff like that. All those compilations were coming out for these obscure bands from like the 60s. That certainly, you know, all of that stuff we listened to and to a certain point played a role in our development. But yeah, I think power pop for sure had was as almost as big of an influence as punk. So
it's funny how melody is such a huge thing for, like, you know, all the bands you kind of brought up so far, and certainly, you know, Soul Asylum a little bit later on as well, and even Halo of Flies, there's like a weird melody kind of running to it. And it doesn't seem like hardcore was as much of a thing later on, as much as sort of like the bands that were doing sort of more melodic stuff. What was the reception to sort of Landspeed at that time, and sort of like, you know, you guys coming back, being, you know, not that you ever rejected melody and certainly ultimately became very melodic, but there was certainly a period where it's like way faster than I'm sure anyone else was doing.
You know, when we returned to Minneapolis after our first tour, that Children's Crusade tour that took us through Canada and all the way down the Pacific Northwest for an extended stay in San Francisco before we came home. We got home and Landspeed record was our recording of our first show back. And it was at the very end of that tour. It was the last show. And it shocked the local people. They were like, what the fuck happened to you guys? You know, because we were so much faster and tighter too, I would add. And some people embraced that and some people didn't like it. You know, they liked the, you know, and actually in a way it's weird because there was certainly a kind of a Manchester influence on the band. And Bob was writing like really great songs, and that kind of then fell to the, you know, to the wayside when Bob was like, okay, I can do hardcore, in which he could. And sometimes maybe I think that he was like going like, yeah, watch me write hardcore. I can do this too and do it better than you can. Not that he was saying that, you know, out loud or anything, but, you know, Husker definitely could, you know, hold their own with any of the West Coast hardcore bands.
Mm-hmm. On that first run, you're in Calgary for like a week or something.
Yeah, a week at the Calgarian. That was, yeah. That was a, and we were playing three sets a night.
Oh my God.
That's right. And the first couple of nights, the hotel wanted to fire us and some locals came to our, defense, and actually they're like, oh, come on, give these guys a chance. And, they rallied some local bands to, you know, show up and play with us for like the last few nights. And, it ended up being great. Part of our pay was we had one room, which happened to be right above, so one floor up above the main entrance. So we'd get done playing our set or playing our shows. We'd get paid. They'd give us a case of beer. We'd go upstairs and, drink beer and watch, all the drunks spill out of the bar and get in fights out on, in front of the hotel. That was our entertainment. And, yeah, that run at the Calgarian ended up being really great. And we, you know, we went back and played Calgary again, another time. So yeah, that was our first stretch of shows outside of, the Midwest, Minneapolis and Chicago. That's all we had played up until that point.
It's kind of like a real trial by fire, I imagine, playing to like a punk crowd. Like, obviously, the punk crowd were probably very awesome, but I mean, like a local crowd in Calgary at that point, too, that were just happened to be in
right.
The bar.
Yep. Because, you know, Calgary being a big, you know, cow town,
oil town.
Yep, exactly. So during the day, it was the bar was, you know, cowboys and oil workers. And, you know, after like 6 o'clock, then the punks started to come in, but the regulars stayed. They didn't leave, you know, which was interesting. And I don't think they necessarily liked what we were doing, but by, you know, like I said, by the end of the week, everything was a lot better. Although the very last night, the bartender, some drunk cowboy punched the bartender over the bar, punched him in the face, gave him a bloody nose. That kind of sucked. But besides that, those were some fun shows.
It's interesting to kind of think that, like, you know, you guys ultimately are carving this path that, you know, on your tour, you're still following, like, this path that, like, you know, I think it's credit to Black Flag. I think more recently people are realizing it was actually probably DOA, right? That was the original sort of.
Yep.
Architect.
Yeah, DOA and also the Subhumans from
absolutely, yeah,
from Vancouver. Yep. DOA, actually DOA and the Subhumans both had come through Minneapolis and played at the 7th Street Entry. We opened up for both bands. That's how we got to know these guys. It's actually Ken Lester, who was the DOA's manager, that hooked me up with the connection for the Calgarian. So we played Calgary for that week. From there, we went and actually stayed with Dave Gregg, with DOA. We spent maybe a couple weeks or at least a week there. And we played, you know, a couple shows at the Smiling Buddha. We went over, we played Victoria with opening for the Subhumans on Canada Day. And DOA actually in Vancouver that day, DOA was opening up for Stiff Little Fingers, and Stiff Little Fingers were like one of our favorite bands ever. You know, they were just such a huge influence, but we couldn't go to that show because we were over in Victoria. Fast forward up until just a couple of years ago, I meet Henry Clooney. Henry lives in Rochester, Minnesota. when he had his brain tumor, he the Mayo Clinic operated on him. He decided to, you know, met a local woman. Basically, he lives in Rochester when he's not back over in Ireland touring with XSLF. And Henry is a super nice guy. He actually jumped up and played. We played some songs together in Porcupine, the band that I was in before, Ultra Bomb. And so that was a huge thrill.
On that first tour, you guys spent a lot of time in Seattle, and I was wondering, that was probably with the Fastbacks, I imagine, right?
No, it wasn't with the Fastbacks. So a friend of ours, Peter Davis from Minneapolis, and he put out a fanzine called Your Flesh, which I think is still around. And so he had some friends and kind of hooked us up there for a place to stay. And we play a show at this small club, meet some people. The Dead Kennedys are coming to town, and we somehow miraculously get ourselves talked onto the bill as the opening band. So it was us, a local band called The Farts, where the A has got a circle around it, because, you know, that's punk. And then DOA and the Dead Kennedys. And Jello Biafra was like, holy shit, you guys are, that was amazing. It's like, well, where are you going from here? It's like, well, we have one show booked in Portland after this. We want to go to California, but we don't have anything. We don't have any shows. And he's like, come on down to San Francisco. You can stay with me. And Biafra got us our, talked to Dirk Dirksen at Mabue and got us on some bills there. So we played a couple of shows at the Mabue Gardens. We did a festival in a park over in Berkeley. While we were there, we got a show up in Sacramento. You know, we were in San Francisco long enough that I technically qualified for food stamps. And I think I still have the receipt from the city office when I went down and got food stamps. We ate good that night. Took our per diem money and bought beer instead of food. So
that Farts also featured Duff McKagan. A young Duff McKagan on bass from Guns N' Roses. Really? Yeah. And
funny. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And I think he told me this, or it might have been Bob, but someone told me that he was watching TV and you guys came in and threw him out of the room so you could watch wrestling. So
that sounds right. We probably did.
Yep. Yeah. So were you a big wrestling fan as well?
Yes, I was. So, That was just one of those goofy things where, you know, Bob shows up in Minnesota and, you know, Minnesota was the Minneapolis was the home of the American Wrestling Association, the AWA, which was Vern Gagne and,
everyone came through the AWA. Like that's famously where Vince stole, the future of, you know, mainstream American wrestling that came through that promotion.
Oh yeah, Vince totally stole everybody from the AWA, but the future governor of Minnesota was AWA Jesse the Body Ventura with the three of us went to the St. Paul Civic Center for this big AWA match where Jesse and Adrian Adonis won the World Tag Team Championship, you know. So it's like I had been watching wrestling since I was a little kid. It would come on what, Saturday mornings or Sunday mornings, and you'd watch it. And I remember my granddad used to watch it. You know, the local circuit would. They'd get around the Midwest. They'd like play the Quad Cities, you know, they'd play all around. So yeah, no, it'd been a big part of entertainment for me for a long time. Yep. And then Bob loved it so much that, you know, he went on to work in the industry.
And you guys played Wrestling Challenge, I just saw. Like, I was looking at a list of Husker Du shows, and one of them was Wrestling Challenge. That AWA show?
That I don't recall.
Okay. I was like, I've never heard about that before.
We did play in a wrestling ring in Madison Square Gardens, which happened to be a warehouse on the outskirts of Phoenix. And it was called Madison Square Garden. It was the stage. You literally played inside the wrestling ring. There was the chain link fence separating the ring from the audience. And, you know, basically there was kind of an open floor and then some bleachers. And that was a fun show.
Yeah.
There were people hanging on the chain link fence you know, of course, and then when we showed up before we set up the equipment, you know, everybody took a turn on the bouncing around on the turnbuckles and stuff. So
that was, I think, JFA's venue, or JFA played there too quite a bit, right? I think
it could be. Yep, probably.
That Arizona scene's wild, like the Feeders, Mighty Sphincter, and stuff like that. Like, it feels like every scene back then had its kind of like own unique style. You know, and it's something that I think is probably changing now, because I think, you know, obviously the accessibility of culture and music is just so different. But at that time, it feels like every town kind of had, you know, New Orleans punk wasn't necessarily like Arizona punk, which wasn't at all like the stuff that was happening in Austin.
Right. Yeah, totally. It's like every, you know, it's.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Every scene had their own bubble, right? You know, and it's pre-internet, it's pre, which I thought was great. You know, you've got these little bubbles of congruent evolution popping up, but everybody's got their own slightly different take on it, you know?
Yeah. You mentioned earlier being into like the Manchester stuff. When you guys played La Hacienda in 85, was that like significant at that point, or was that kind of before that kind of like had sunk in culturally?
No, that was like, holy shit, we're playing the Hacienda. This is great. You know? So it registered, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What was that tour in Europe like in 85, like going, because you guys went all over there. I think you went to Sweden and stuff too.
That was a really good tour. So yeah, we did Norway, Sweden, I don't think we did Finland until 87. A couple of shows in the Netherlands, a few shows in Germany. We did Austria, a lot of shows in England and in Scotland. That was a really good tour. Yeah.
It's interesting to kind of think of that as well, because, you know, now for bands from, you know, Canada and America, going to Europe is just part of the thing after a certain point. But at that point, international touring was still, you know, like there's different currencies in every single city you go to.
And yeah. That was one of the things. It's touring through Europe. Every day it was a new language and a new type of money. You had to figure out, like, okay, how much is this now that I have in my hand? I don't, you know, so you trying to buy something, you'd be like, yeah, here's a handful of money. Just take whatever you need, you know? And that tour in 85, it was just, the three of us plus, Zop Yard, our tour manager, and Mick Brown, a couple of English guys that you know, Mick did our stage setup and stage sound. And so we were our own roadies. So we played in Hamburg. And the opening bands are done. And so we're setting up our gear, and everybody, all the punks are just kind of milling around. And then we start playing. And nobody's really paying attention to us. And it's about three or four songs in when people go like, oh shit, I think this is actually Husker Du. This is the band that we're here to see. And talking to some people afterwards, they're like, well, you know, we never seen any photos of the band. We didn't know what you guys look like. We, you know, from like, you know, listening to like Land Speed record, we just thought you were like all these would be like all like six and with big huge mohawks and black leather jackets and just, you know, super punks. And yeah, we thought you were just the roadies and just kind of doing a sound check. And we're like, nope. And after that, Grant and I walked through the after everybody had left, we're kind of walking through the venue, and we did see a few Husker Du buttons that looked like they had been thrown down in disgust and stomped. These guys aren't punk.
A very German response to punk bands to this day, in some cases.
Yep.
What were those shows, mainly kind of like squat venues, or were you already kind of playing club shows by that point?
No, these were all club shows.
Yeah.
You know, actually, when we played England and in Europe, they were all legitimate club shows. We didn't do any squat shows, because we were actually working with an agency called The Agency, so they were, you know, booking us into real venues.
Oh, you're already with The Agency by that point?
Yep.
Oh, wow. So that must have come pretty early, I guess, like in terms of like, were you in North America, were you still being booked through SST early?
Well, no, actually SST never booked us. We were self-booked, until let's see, we had Frank Riley take over probably right after Zen Arcade. So at the beginning of 85.
Okay.
And I can't think of what Frank used to call his agency. It's High Road Touring now, but, anyway, yeah, Frank Riley and when he just started out.
It's interesting too, because you're also providing like a roadmap that I think future bands that play aggressive music wind up following, in terms of like, how do you pursue this long term? What do you do in terms of like trying to level up, but not, you know, necessarily go for it in the way that a punk band probably shouldn't necessarily go for it? You know, like, you know, getting to that point in our band's career where, you know, you're not necessarily a hardcore band anymore, but like, what are you next?
You know, and in a way that is the most punk thing that you can do, is evolve and change. And you're going to end up leaving fans behind that don't want you to change, but that's just how it goes, you know? it's you grow as a person, you grow as a musician and a songwriter, your outlook on life changes constantly, you know. I did a interview for Psychology Today a few years ago, and we talked exactly about this and how, you know, for a lot of fans, they there's like one thing that they like, oh, that album is the best thing ever. And then you can never do anything after that that will equal that. And so as you evolve, new fans though will pick up on what you're doing, and they pick something that is their benchmark. So fans get mad when bands evolve, but really, like, punk is about, you know, doing what you want to do. Do it yourself. Do, you know, it's not conforming to what somebody else thinks you should be or sound like. And so if you piss fans off along the way, I guess you're just being punk, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, like, it's funny, Glenn Matlock was recently on the show, and he was talking about, like, just the fact that he still has to, the Sex Pistols was just like this little fraction of my life.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Even as a songwriter, as amazing as it is, it's also ultimately a bit of a burden to just have to be like almost answer for it for the rest of your life. Something you did as a teenager that really,
yeah, that's his albatross, right?
Yeah. One record, one, like, and I love all his stuff. Like the Creation record, I think that he did years later is awesome. I think he's a great songwriter. The Holy Spirit stuff he did with Iggy, you know, but certainly that is a heavy cultural thing to kind of bear, I guess.
Yeah. You know, and you hear that from people all the time, how they like, oh, I have to play this one thing, or, you know, and I fucking can't stand it anymore. But that's what the people are there for.
Well, I think now it's even worse, right? Because of TikTok, you hear about these artists that have these shows where people are only there for 15 seconds. They're not even there for the hit anymore.
Right. Yep. Yeah, I can believe that. That's insane. Yep.
Jumping back to Ken Lester, I just kind of wanted to, you know, have, if you have any memories of Ken, because he's someone who has come up a lot on this show in a lot of different ways, I think, over the years, but someone that, you know, as you said, had like a huge impact on the way we tour this music and this music in general.
Ken was a, he's a super nice guy, or I don't know. Is he still alive?
I think he passed away last year, if I'm not mistaken. Oh,
okay. Sorry to hear that. He was a super nice guy. And if that's not right, he still is a super nice guy. Anyway, he was really helpful. You know, he recognized that we had something and that we wanted to go beyond just our local stage. And he did everything that he could do to help us with phone numbers so when we got to Vancouver, you know, we hung out with Ken, probably Ken and Dave more than anybody else. But like I said, he did what he could to help get us on shows, help us, you know, get the word out. You know, that the 1981, you know, the 82, 83, those early touring years, I mean, it really was like the Wild West. Everybody was always like, you know, looking for a city that had a venue that would, first off, would have you in to play. And you knew that there was like, okay, there's a scene, there's something starting there. So like, let's go and let's play. And, you know, Ken was just really great with sharing information. And like I said, super nice guy.
It's fascinating how many ex sort of yippies wind up being sort of foundational, that early punk scene, you know, like that Madam's Organ venue in DC being a yippie spot. And I can't remember the guy's name now, out of New York, that was like key involved in the scene. And Ken Lester, obviously, like, it feels like that was sort of an interesting kind of holdover or something, like, you know, in the same way there was proto punk music, there's like proto DIY activist culture that almost is sort of foundational to this too.
I guess it's people that don't want to just settle for the status quo, fight against the being normal. I don't know. Yeah.
And you guys met Burroughs too, right? Like there was a...
We did. Yep. So the, through John Giorno in New York and the Giorno poetry system guy. So Giorno was a fan of ours. And the first time that we played New York, was a club called Great Gildersleeves in the Bowery. And it was really close to where Burroughs had an apartment. So that's the first time we met Burroughs. There's a photo that's out on the internet of the three of us. Burroughs is standing up. John Giorno's in the photo as well. We all have canes. When we started playing in Lawrence, we were invited to Bill's place, and we met him at his home. The very first time, he's like, "Oh, I don't really have anything to offer you, but there's a little bit of vodka there, and there's some flat warm Diet Coke if you want a drink." And we're all like, "Oh, that's okay." But one of my best memories of going to Bill Burroughs's house in Lawrence was he taught us how to throw knives back behind the house next to the garage. And so we're all out there, we're throwing knives at like this big wood plank type thing. And obviously Grant and Bill Burroughs became better friends. And that was cool.
What kind of hang was he? Like, obviously you're out there throwing knives, but like, was he chill? Was he a funny guy, or is it like fairly?
He definitely had a dry sense of humor. So, yeah. Wouldn't necessarily say that he was a spitball firecracker type of a personality, but it was fun.
It's interesting because like Ginsberg also with the Gluons in Colorado and like doing a punk record with them and doing that kind of punk solo spoken word record on local, whatever that record label is. Sorry, I'm blanking on now. But, it feels like they're another, like sort of this other group that's kind of like, kind of waiting for punk in a way and like proto punk in a spiritual way.
Mm-hmm. I guess in a way we're kind of channeling the same things that the rest of us are, taking a stand against being boring and normal. I don't know.
Because at a certain point, you walk away from music. Like at the end of Husker Du, Grant and Bob kind of run off and look like they're they were kind of like in a hurry to kind of do other stuff. But you kind of step away, and now here you're kind of like back getting into touring in a way. And I know you've done other stuff over the years, but I kind of want to talk to you about like the change in, you mentioned the evolution of a human being over the course of their lifetime, but like, the evolution away from this and then the evolutions back to it at different points. Like,
yeah.
Do you find yourself getting burnt out? Is that it? Or is it more just like you want to avoid getting burnt out and that's why you're walking away at different times?
Yeah. So Husker Du breaks up, at the beginning of 1988. And, it's basically like Bob just took the keys and ran with it. A year later, he's got his solo record. Oddly enough, he's still with the same booking agent. He still has the same manager that Husker had. He's got a new record label. Grant is off, and Grant is doing a bunch of different projects and in a way trying to keep up and compete with what Bob's doing. I had another band right after Husker broke up, but we never really, we recorded some stuff in the studio, never got it finished. Did one tour in the middle of the summer, which was the worst time to go out on the road. And then we kind of, you know, the guitar player decided he didn't want to be a guitar player anymore. And so that was kind of it. In the meantime, I'm working in restaurants. That's, you know, what I had been doing in the early days of Husker, and was back in restaurants, and meet a guy named Lenny Russo, who is who's this chef. And he, you know, I go to work at a place where he is the chef at, and then end up kind of following, becoming really good friends with him, following him around various places. And eventually he talks me into the back of the kitchen and starts to teach me how to cook. And from there, that ends up being a very long career in the restaurant business as a chef. Lenny goes on to, you know, be one of the top Minnesota chefs, frequently nominated for James Beard Best Chef Awards, but he was kind of the Susan Lucci of the James Beard Awards. He frequently nominated and never gets the trophy, always losing out to either somebody in Chicago or Kansas City. But that really was, you know, at a time where we're actually in, even restaurants were evolving as far as like what food was and how you prepare food and farm to table, and ended up working with all of these really incredible, talented people that, and a lot of us went on to have our own places, and that was like you say, it was part of my development, part of how I see the world, part of how I think, part of how I experience things, broadening my palate. You know, it's like always being open to try new things, to check things out, having an open mind to the world. And it was a deep dive, you know, and it was long hours. It was hot. It was hard. It was, I've said before to people in interviews that there is definitely an analogy to working in a kitchen where you're doing creative food and playing in a band where, you know, you show up and you get your mise en place in together. That's like your sound check. You've got everything ready, and then you know, it's showtime. Your menu is your set list. You just don't know how many times you're going to have to play the same song over again. And then it's hot, it's sweaty, it's loud. At the end of the of service, you get done and you go out, and people are like, "Oh, that was great, best thing I ever ate," you know. And so you have, it's almost like you have that instant response where they're either like, "That was really great," or sometimes they're like, "Wow, that, you suck," you know.
Yeah.
which and that is, I think, as important. People, you need to hear people tell you when you do suck, so that you can be better. If you are constantly being told that, "Wow, that was great, everything you do is great," eventually you start to think, "Hey, everything I do is great." And then there's like no room for improvement. So, and then also with the restaurant business, then, like, you know, you kick everybody out and it's, the club is closed and everybody sits down and smokes cigarettes and has a drink. So I literally did not play bass for like 14 years. Wow. Didn't even pick one up. Wow. And then I met a guy named Dave King from jazz band The Bad Plus, and they had just released a record where they play Smells Like Teen Spirit, and I'm like, "Wow, these guys are pretty cool." And they were from Minneapolis, and there was an article leading up to a show that they were playing where they talked about how Husker Du was an influence on them, and being a jazz fan, really liking this new record. I went to see that show and introduced myself afterwards. And Dave King was like, hey, I've got an idea for a band. You should be in this band with me. And that band ends up being Gang Font. So it took another 2 years of us claiming that we were once someday going to get together. But he kind of is the guy that got me to pick up a bass again and start noodling around. And, you know, I think, you know, the first Gang Font record is kind of, you know, well, this is what happens to a bass player when he doesn't touch the bass for 14 years and then just, and then doesn't play with anybody when he picks it up and starts playing again. So, Gang Font is still an ongoing thing, even though we haven't played a show in about 5 years. And we've got a second record recorded, but it's been recorded for now almost 13 years. So I like to claim it's our Grand Reserva. It's we've been cellaring it for all this time, and now it's finally ready to be released and opened up on the world, and hopefully that'll see the light of day sometime in the next year or so.
So is it around this time that you wind up playing with Shotgun Rationale too?
You know, actually no. Shotgun Rationale was in So the band that I had right after Husker broke up was called Gray Area. Mm-hmm. Gray Area had been broken up for maybe a little over a year, year and a half. And Sonny Vincent calls me up out of the blue and says, like, hey, I'm going to do this tour in Canada and I want you to be my bass player. And he's telling me about the band and how Cheetah Chrome has been in the band and Bob Stinson had been in the band. And sends me a couple of, I think probably cassettes, you know, so I listened to it and I'm like, yeah, okay, I can play this. This is kind of some fun stuff. And, you know, Sonny was he's like that old school New York, like late 70s kind of punk.
The Testers, you know? And.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yep. And, he picks me up in Red Wing, Minnesota. We drive to Cincinnati to pick up the other guitar player who's got his own roadie. And then we go to New York where Gary Taylor, the drummer, lived. And that's where we rehearsed. Gary Taylor had been in a metal band in England called Tank.
Yeah, of course.
And then we went and we did our run of shows through Canada, and it was a lot of fun. It was, you know, we're playing punk rock. It was, you know, and this is, you know, and I always at the end of Husker, I'm up, was always telling people, it's like, oh, punk rock's not dead. It's not going away. It'll be back. You just mark my words on it. And we're playing punk and we're just having a blast. And Sonny's like, oh man, you guys should come to Europe. I can get us all these gigs. And I was like, okay, I would love to come to Europe. But I'm going to need to see contracts and I'm going to need to see guarantees. Otherwise I can't afford to do it. I can't go to Europe just hoping that I'm going to make money. And he can never, you know, produce anything like that because he's probably playing squats, right? So they're not doing guarantees. They're not doing contracts. So Sonny and I part ways, but then for like the next decade, every once in a while, I'll get a postcard from Europe and from Sonny, like, hey, look where I'm playing. Wish you were here. You know, and I'm like, ah, oh, you fucker. So that was a short little run, but it was fun.
Who was the guitar player with his own roadie?
Paul. His first name was Paul. I want to say his last name was Young, but I'm not positive. I'd have to go and look it up. But and I can't remember the roadie's name, but they were kind of young and definitely having fun. So
yeah, okay, yeah, it wasn't Cheetah Chrome and Mo Tucker, which I guess played on the record and
right, yeah.
That's wild. So, you know, it's funny because you bring up the restaurant thing and the comparison to the band thing, and just knowing from a bunch of friends that are punk chefs and stuff like that. It's also a world that can kind of churn you up too. And there's like, you know, like you mentioned the alcohol, there's also drugs. There's like, just like, it's such an intense lifestyle, it seems.
Oh yeah. Yep. You know, when Bourdain writes in Kitchen Confidential about, you know, basically it's like, you've got your own pirate crew. That's pretty spot on, you know. It is intense. It can chew you up, and kind of like fuck you up big time. But there again, so can the music industry. You know, if you can handle, I guess it comes down to how you handle pressures like that, you know.
And also, do you know the chef Matty Matheson? Are you familiar with that guy?
I'm not sure.
He does that TV show The Bear now.
And,
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he bonded with the guy from Vice, like got his start over a love of Husker Du. So that was his entryway into this whole thing. And actually, Sarouche from Vice used to live in Minnesota and was like a guy, has a Husker Du tattoo on his arm.
Okay. So
it's wild, like the cultural impact this band has, like, you know, from Robert Palmer covering a song.
Yeah, that was crazy. Yep.
And like the Anthrax cover thing and all this sort of stuff. Are you kind of privy to this thing as it's happening, being someone who's kind of like, you're not even picking up a bass? Like, how in touch with what was going on musically were you able to kind of keep at this point?
A lot of it, I didn't even, you know, realize what was going on. You know, being in the restaurant industry, and also still, you know, the internet was not really, you know, it wasn't a big thing yet. I didn't get my first computer until like, I think 1999 or maybe even 2000. And I remember firing up my computer, like, okay, what is this search thing? And I type in Husker Du, and the Paul Hilcoff Husker Du database page pops up, and I'm like, what the fuck is this? Who is this guy? You know, and I was just like freaking out. It's like, man, he's not Husker Du, you know. So but then it's, then all of a sudden you see the Robert Palmer thing, you know, actually there's a guy, James Ilario out of Los Angeles. He was in a Husker cover band. He actually flew to Minnesota to come to my restaurant in Red Wing, and he was in a Husker Du cover band, and he said that the drummer of the band was the drummer from Anthrax.
I think a couple guys from Anthrax were in that cover band. Mm-hmm. Together, like, it's you know, then of course, you know, Dave Grohl's kind of very vocal about the influence on him. I think like Husker Du and the Melvins are the two bands that really change rock and roll out of that sort of like post hardcore, post punk kind of era.
Yep. The Melvins and Soundgarden opened up for Husker in at the Gorilla Room in Seattle. And it was the Soundgarden's second show ever.
Yeah. It's amazing how like small, you know, well, I guess relatively speaking, I wasn't there, but like, I think in retrospect, how small things were and how many cool people and creative people and talented people gravitated toward this thing that ultimately, you know, like we're talking about at the very beginning, it wasn't mainstream. Like, there's much easier things to be into, you know, and it kind of continues to be this thing. And like, you know, you can just run through all these shows and all these flyers from like Duff McKagan and the Farts to Soundgarden. And that's just in Seattle. We haven't even left Seattle.
Exactly. Yep.
I don't know. It's amazing. Like, do you feel kind of coming back about to go on tour? Like, what are your kind of thoughts on like the way things are now in terms of like where this whole thing has gone, where like, you know, now this trail that you carved is an established sort of like touring circuit, you know, and punk is still like, you talked about it coming back. Here we are. How many years later, hardcore bands are playing Coachella. Like, it really is a part of the cultural landscape.
Right. It's going to be really interesting to get out on the road. You know, what I'm really excited about is to kind of see how thriving and vibrant the scenes are in various spots. And also at the same time, I know that I'm going to be getting to some places that it's going to be a completely like culture shock, different world from what I remember it being. And I'm thinking about Austin in particular here. You know, I haven't been in Austin for 35 plus years. You know, when we first played Austin, it was kind of a sleepy little town.
You're going to be shocked. Anymore. Holy.
Yeah, I know. Right. But I know that there is still a scene out there, you know, and there's still an underground. There's still, you know, people that care and that part I'm looking forward to.
One thing I've got to ask you about, because this blew my mind finding this out today, you and the rest of the band, Husker Du, sang backups on Brotherhood by DYS.
Again, I'm not sure.
This is something that I found out today, and that you were dropped in the studio when they were recording the Brotherhood album and actually sing backups on the chorus. And apparently this is true. This blew my mind.
I'm going to have to go back and double check, because I wonder if it was just Bob and Grant. I don't know. I don't necessarily recall, but.
You're listed on the reissue as being okay. Part of the choir. So definitely, but that is, it's mind blowing that is one of those things that, you know, I never stopped being shocked and surprised at the connections in this world. And so, well, Grant, it has been an honor to have you on the show. And anytime you want to come back on and talk about punk music, rock and roll, or restaurants, even, you are always welcome.
Sounds good. Well, thanks. Thanks for having me. It's been a lot of fun talking with you.
Thank you, Greg, for coming on the show. And you heard right there, Greg can come back whenever he wants for more talk, because there's some more talk to be had. That's for sure. And once again, check out Ultra Bomb on tour, ultrabombmusic.com, to find out dates and to order the LP if you are not able to see them live. I'm sure if you're able to see them live, grab the record. Talk to Greg. Maybe get it signed. Who knows? I'm not promising anything. I'm not promising a single thing, but maybe it happens. Speaking of stuff that I know that will happen, coming up in a few days, I'm going to put it out this week in celebration of that tour I mentioned off the top with the Hallucination, an episode of Turn Out of Punk Splits with Gerard Cosloy, returning to the show, Matador Records owner, proprietor, 12XU owner, proprietor, Conflict Zine, former editor-in-chief, and now and Conflict Records, too. The bands that could be God Comp. A incredible guy. And Daniel McCabe, my buddy, my pal from BC, returning to the show. Daniel reached out and said, would Gerard want to do a splits with me on the show? I said, I don't know. Gerard, you know, you can't force Gerard to do anything. Let me check. I said, Gerard, do you want to do an episode with Daniel? And it's, yeah, Daniel is one of my favorite wrestlers going right now on the indie scene. I would love to do an episode with him. I'm not making this up. This is all, you'll hear all about it on the next episode. It's a fun, fun splits. I love the splits episodes. All right, that is it for me. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives and issues of Indigenous peoples all over the world matter. We need to protect trans kids and help trans people protect themselves and their rights. And stop hate and violence towards people of different races and different faiths, and just knock out all this fascist bullshit, because there is no place in this world for that kind of stuff. This isn't politics. It's not politics. This is just basic human rights stuff. People deserve to be able to live free. And to that, I add, we need to make sure that people are able to choose what they want to do with their reproductive systems, and people keep their hands out of other people's reproductive rights, because that stuff's under attack all over the place, in Canada too. So if there's something that you see in the world that you think should be changed, get involved. You know, try and affect that change yourself. Speaking of getting involved, start a band, start a fanzine. Anyone can do this shit. You know, punk is based on participation. So who knows? Maybe you wind up being like Husker Du and influencing all of rock music. Maybe not. You know, they're one of the greatest bands ever. So this is a high bar to kind of leap over. But, you know, there's lots of other bars on the way up. So maybe one of those. Try meditating. I didn't believe in it. And now I find it really helps me. Maybe it'll help you too. I'm not the first to discover this stuff. I'm not pretending to be. But I definitely didn't believe in it for a long time, and I wish I had sooner. So maybe it'll work for you, too. Sign your organ donor cards, because by the time they come looking for those organs, you don't need them. And I've seen it. I've seen it with my own eyes. It can perform miracles for people. So, you know, it's literally dead weight at that point. Oh, geez, I normally do it in a different order, so I don't end on the downer point. Well, the meditation stuff. Start a band, start a fanzine. All right, everyone, though, that is it for me. Thank you for listening, and I will see you on the next episode. Bye.